Today we have the pleasure of hosting Milford Bateman, a real expert of economy and local development in the region. He has worked on the region, especially Croatia, for many years, Bosnia, from the beginning of when it all started, or when the war ended. So he has very intimate knowledge of the region and of the economy. He has a PhD. He studied also the region in his PhD in Bradford University, and then he moved, I think, in the late 90s or early 2000s.
Late 90s.
In the region, and he's worked there in various capacities as a consultant, a freelance consultant, and also working on local economic development policy and projects, also for international institutions, the World or projects funded by the World Bank, the European Commission, the UNDP, and others. Since 2005, he's visiting professor of economics at the URAI Dobrilja University in Pula, with my very good accent. And since 2014, he's also adjunct professor of development studies at St. Mary's University in Halifax, Canada. Better accent there. The topic he's going to talk to us about today is really looking at the issue of microcredit, and more generally the neoliberal recipe on supporting or not supporting growth and development in countries in the region. But I think then the region, at the end of the presentation, we're going to open up and include Greece also, as you told me, in the region. Milford has looked at these issues not only in the space of former Yugoslavia, but also increasingly in other parts of the world, including Latin America. And Southeast Asia, and he is a very well cited and referenced source on these issues, mostly in relation to his 2010 book, Why Doesn't Microfinance Work? The Destructive Rise of Local Neoliberalism, which I think also is sort of an entry point also for your presentation today. So, without further ado.
Okay, thanks very much. That's nice. It's great to be back here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the microcredit aspect, but what I'm really wanting to explore here, and it comes out of, I think, a lot of growing anger, is the way that there is a movement now afoot in institutions like the World Bank and the EU to, as I say later on, to blame the victim. So the economies in the 1990s took the advice of the World Bank and the EU and the IMF and USAID and DFID, and we've created a disaster in the Balkans in the post-conflict period. And so now the institutions are saying, well, you know, it was actually all the Bosnian or the Croatian or the Macedonian or the Serbian politicians. If they had have only followed our advice, they'd have done a lot better. And I think that is so, so wrong. My background is in research, but then I left and I went to be an advisor at the OECD on something called the Stability Pact. So I was on that, I was the small business advisor on that, and I saw it from the inside. Then I headed up a consulting, one of the big five consulting companies, White Young Green International, opened an office in the Balkans. And so I headed up that for 4 years. And so I saw at close hand how you deal with institutions like the World Bank and the EU and DFID and all the others, and the extent of aid conditionality. You know, you do what we say or you simply don't get the money. And I've been in meetings and I've had all sorts of issues to do with that. Never really written anything about it, because for obvious reasons that as a freelance consultant, once you start insulting the client, you never get any repeat business. Although I am thinking of a book later on to do some other to put this into on paper. So really I'm going to focus, that's my background, is on the research, but also working in consulting on policy projects. So I just want to, as a way of background, just want to look very quickly at Yugoslavia, because as we were just discussing earlier, many people saw Yugoslavia as part of the sort of trend within Eastern Europe, the communist economies, as very bad, not doing very well. Well, that wasn't quite the case. The Yugoslavs had a radically different model called worker self-management. And by no means was it the be-all and end-all of industrial democracy or economic efficiency, but it wasn't half bad. And it certainly wasn't half bad when you look with, you know, in retrospect, you look back and they call it something called Yugo nostalgia. So why was it that in the 1960s and 70s, living standards, taking the whole sort of, you know, issues like income, security, all those things, why was it so much better in the 60s and 70s than it is now? And that's something that's growing up. So I think there are aspects, and I certainly think the industrial democracy aspect, it wasn't complete, but it was certainly an advance on the Western forms of enterprise governance in the sense that there was a very big element of participation. It wasn't complete, but it was there. They had social structures, solid social structures. So poverty was very low and there was high social security. They had banking structures that more or less were able to intermediate finance into the best enterprises. And they had an enterprise sector that was open to new innovations and technologies. And the famous example is that Yugoslav firms were more into mainframes in the big companies than Austria and Italy combined. And I got that from the head of Microsoft working in the Balkans, so it must be true. So the potential for a successful transition was there. And what I'm interested in is, why did it all go so wrong? And it wasn't just because of the war. So we had the Yugoslav Civil War, and then at the end of the war, the international development community descended on the region with a view to reconstructing it, but reconstructing it under particular economic principles, because in the 1990s, in the 1980s, we had the rise of the neoliberal project, the neoliberal consensus, Washington consensus. And when they descended upon the region, there was a feeling, even though the neoliberal consensus was quite clearly going wrong elsewhere in Eastern Europe, the example of Russia, the example of Poland, all these economies were in very, very deep trouble. They still said, no, it can somehow work in an even more complicated environment. And the aid was there. So certainly if the policy had worked, the money to fund the policies were there. Bosnia famously had more money per capita than Western Europe under the Marshall Plan. Now, my interest is on the local aspect of transition, so I make no big claims on the macroeconomic impact or anything like that. I'm really just looking at the aspects of local neoliberalism, because there was a feeling that we had to promote the private sector at the local level, and we had to, in a sense, get rid of the virus of planning or industrial policies or whatever. So we had to produce a very sort of entrepreneur-led neoclassical model, and anything to do with planning was considered too close to the old style of communism. Another main aim of the international development community at the local level, almost as much as at the national level, was to invalidate and dismantle any form of state capacity. And certainly that was something that most of them were into. And also there was a major effort to ensure that any aid money that was dispersed, and I know this directly because my company that I was working for was involved in this, none of the aid money could be used to improve state capacity. State capacity was out of the question. It had to go on to non-state or private sector-led types of projects. And so the local consulting community, the aid agencies, the consulting companies knew what the agenda was. We all knew what the agenda was. We had many arguments. I worked in Bosnia during and after the war, and I met many government officials that said, well, we need a Marshall Plan. They looked to, for example, the Emilia-Romagna region of Italy, which had a very sizable military industrial sector, which then was successfully converted into the Emilia-Romagna success, became one of the richest regions in Europe. So a lot of government officials were going there, and they would come back, and the World Bank officials said, well, you can forget all that nonsense right away. We're absolutely not going to go into all that sort of state intervention. So if you're going to go down that line, the aid money is going to very swiftly dry up. And so there was a very clear idea of what was going on. And a lot of the individuals working around the time, the government officials, the advisors, the academics, realised the way the wind was blowing. And so whether they liked it or not, they, in a sense, shifted over to accepting this ideology. Well, you can't beat them. You might as well join them. So in a sense, you had an undercurrent of support, but a little bit resistant support from locals. So, in a sense, slightly going in advance, but none of the main constituent parties to the transition in the Balkans really want anything to do with the disaster that we now see before us. It had nothing to do with them. It was all down to the Bosnian people, the Croatian people, or whatever it was. Now, at the local level, as I say, the policy was all about, and to sum it up, it was do as we say, but not as we did. So one of the key aspects of the local neoliberal programmes was to create formal, small and medium enterprises. This is where the jobs were going to come. The old socialist dinosaur companies were going to be done away with or privatised. The job creation, which was the key to a successful transition, was going to come from small and medium businesses. They would reduce poverty, create tax, etc., etc. And neoliberals working within the World Bank and particularly EBRD as well were very much of an opinion that there would be support would be required to push this movement forward. But the support should not come from the state, it should come from this thing called the market. Okay? So in an ideal world, the market will somehow vector into existence the support structures that will support small and medium enterprises. The state should play no role in really forming and still less running these institutions. There was also a firm belief that we needed capitalist institutions and they would automatically ensure that whatever money was available, whether it was from the international aid community or domestic savings or increasingly remittance income, would somehow be intermediated into the highest value uses. So nothing to do with state development banks or directed credit or anything like that. So what I'm saying is at the local level, the idea of what we might call an industrial policy approach to reconstruction was absolutely off the agenda. Okay, so the state was going to keep out of the affair, and it was all going to be left to private sector actors through automatic sort of market driven processes. Now, the rather interesting thing about this particular approach is it flies in the face of historical experience. And I can well remember conferences where there were people invited from Japan and Germany and Northern Italy to impress upon them how the other examples of post-conflict reconstruction went ahead, and they were certainly not listened to. Now, there were three, I've just put three down here, of sort of historical episodes of reconstruction, or at least development. Now, we now know that the developed Western economies very much had a powerful, what we call a developmental state, behind the rise to power. Now, people like Hajun Chang have exposed this, what we call the hidden developmental state. There's an ideology that it was all to do with the market and private incentives, but in actual fact, the state underpins, driving forward innovation, driving forward research and development, funding the key technologies. So that's now becoming, it was very much a minority view, but it's becoming accepted. The state was very much behind the East Asian miracle economies. Okay? So the state very much took control, intermediated the capital to where it was needed, ensured a regulated environment, maybe had things like tariffs and performance measurements on exports and things, but did things which were very pro-development. And even today in the USA, which is seen as the bastion of neoliberalism, it's a very state-dominated economy. I don't know whether you've... I think you've had Mariana Mazzucato here because she talks about how Apple, for example, was very much a state-driven company. Now, that seems to fly in the face of evidence, but virtually all the technologies incorporated into the key Apple items were state-funded. So the risk was taken by the state, and then the private sector comes along and just picks them off the shelf, but then puts nothing back in. And her book became a success, a whirlwind success around the world, because it showed that Apple basically takes technologies off the shelf that were funded and risk taken by the state, but actually pays nothing back in tax. If you remember, this was the thing about there's an office with two people and a dog in Ireland, which runs through $80 billion of sales in Western Europe. So the local policy response I just want to quickly talk about is two reasons. So we had we needed market-driven institutions to promote small and medium enterprises. Okay, so somehow they had to be market-driven. And then we had market-driven microcredit to promote informal micro-enterprises, which was an aspect of poverty reduction alleviation. So you had a twin-track approach. The jobs would come from formal SMEs, and the poverty alleviation and inclusion would come from market-driven microcredit. And enormous support was vectored into building these institutions, including states were building these institutions, and enormous program support came from the usual suspects. Very quickly, talking about enterprise support institutions. It's a shame Will Bartlett's not here, because Will and I did so many evaluations of these down the years. So he's as familiar with this as I am. So they were designed to promote a solution to unemployment through formal small and medium enterprise development. But the market doesn't always work, at least the market as it's applied to these institutions. These institutions were set up as for-profit companies. And the idea was that if you gave them some seed capital and a little bit of training, they would automatically find clients to give support to in return for fees. So it seemed like the magic, the holy grail. These things would help the small enterprises, but they will not be a cost to the state. They will earn their fees on the market. And it will be financially self-sustaining. And so at the same time, regulations had to be slashed in order that these entrepreneurs would come out of the woodwork and they would be able to match up to these support institutions. Hey presto, you'd have formal institutions. And this became known as the new paradigm model. The ILO called it the new paradigm model, that you had business enterprise support and it was really mediated through the market. And you also had this thing called the enabling environment, so that entrepreneurs were able to go about their business without the overbearing state doing anything for it. So these institutions, they were called enterprise support centres, business development units, regional enterprise support centres. They proliferated throughout Eastern Europe and throughout the Balkans, a major, major aspect of spending. As I say, all supposed to earn their keep on the market, selling their services to individual entrepreneurs or companies. They weren't going to be a burden on the state. And another aspect of it was that any existing capacity to support enterprise development within the state had to be slimmed down and passed over to these private sector equivalents. So anybody, for example, in Croatia, they had entrepreneurship centres within local governments. These had to be closed down and the responsibility passed over to the private sector, whether the governments liked it or not. And as I say, there was no support for a local government-led industrial policy in the Balkans, a sort of Northern Italy style. Now, the results are that within a few years, all of these institutions set up by the EU, KfW, World Bank, UNDP, all of them started to collapse. And the simple reason was, well, one of the simple reasons was that entrepreneurs didn't have the cash to pay for business support. Okay? Almost by definition, they're struggling to get business ideas going. They don't have the cash to support these. So the idea that somehow entrepreneurs would be able to fund these business centres to provide advice really was a non-starter. The few that actually made money out of supporting enterprises, they were then privatised by the people who were in them, and they very quickly shifted out of supporting enterprises because there was no real money in that, and working for the donors or for big multinationals. So even when they succeeded, they didn't stay for very long helping small, medium enterprises. They moved into much richer pastures. But they had the offices up, they had a brand name, they had training, they had a reputation within the community, but they shifted over to something else. The other problem they had was they needed to raise money to keep themselves going. So the best way to do this was to work with anybody who had a business idea and could just pay a little bit of money. So somebody wanted to set up a shop, you know, you did a business plan, they paid you, end of story. There was no real mileage in supporting a company through a long process of setting up, through training, through bringing the capital, the technology together. That was a long term, that was risky. No companies would pay for that, so you never got into that. And at the same time, local governments were dumbed down as a result of all this going on. And we saw this through regional operational programs in Croatia, which were designed to kickstart these private sector equivalents and make sure that local government knew that it had to contract its own support. So the result was very little impetus behind small and medium enterprise development in the Balkans. That's why we have 35% unemployment in Bosnia, 40% in Kosovo, 40% in Macedonia, etc., etc. I mean, the results were very bad. Second, we had this thing called microcredit, which was about poverty alleviation. This was the this was coming out of Bangladesh fame, and it was designed to support the very poorest individuals who could set up some informal business. The lead was taken by the World Bank with its local initiative project in Bosnia. Many other donors came on board. And amazingly, Bosnia, by 2005-06, was second to Bangladesh in terms of the extent, the penetration of microcredit within the economy. So this was basically what Bosnia was all about. So that was the idea that microfinance was going to be, we'd have all these micro-entrepreneurs doing things together and poverty would be a thing of the past. I mean, I've just put some results down. We did a paper with Dean Sinkovic and Marin Kushkari. You can see it. And I think I did something here a couple of years ago. So you've got that. But basically, the whole idea behind microcredit hasn't been able to develop any sustainable enterprises. Most of the microcredit actually went on consumption spending. Very little actually went on setting up an informal business. If you look at all the Balkan economies, most of the microcredit has gone into consumption spending. Most of the people supplying the microcredit became a new financial elite, supplying all this money. We had waves of fraud in the newly deregulated environment, and there's some famous big frauds have taken place in Bosnia. And importantly, the informal sector has crowded out the formal sector. So you have a formal sector engineering company trying to use new technology, trying to produce decent products. And all around, you have little informal sector companies which don't pay tax, don't respect labour laws, social contributions, etc., etc. And they take a little bit of demand from the formal company. And they basically eat away at the demand. So the formal company goes nowhere and then eventually goes out of business. And then eventually all even the informal businesses go out of business. So it had a very negative effect on trying to formalise the Balkans economies. We had gender disempowerment because women were herded into the most, the least sustainable businesses possible on the idea of gender empowerment, souvenir selling, washing clothes on the street. And there was a huge amount of resentment to this, justifiably. And it ended up collapsing most of the programmes on that. And I think one of the biggest problems we had is that a lot of the aid money and a lot of the banking capital actually went into informal businesses and very little went into formal businesses. So we had a major opportunity cost. Okay, so whatever scarce capital they had in the Balkans, the banks were actually more interested in channeling it into informal micro-enterprises because interest rates were high, and SMEs, which were more risky and couldn't pay more than 5 or 10% interest rates, they said, well, we're not going to work with that particular model. So it was a private sector-driven opportunity cost we had there. Okay, so overall results of the two combinations. So on the one hand, almost no substantive support to SMEs, and on the other hand, massive support for the microcredit option. The combined result was to deindustrialise, to primitivise, to disconnect, because a lot of these businesses don't have any reason to subcontract or network or cluster because they're too primitive, they're too simple, and informalise. So you had this trend all over Eastern Europe and all over the Balkans in particularly. And if you wanted to sum it up, the result at the local level was that the local economy has been dumbed down and not so much scaled up. Now, how did this happen? Well, my argument would be that this was because what was being promoted in Eastern Europe and particularly in the Balkans was not best practice, but ideology masquerading as best practice. And I think there was a sense of Cold War triumphalism. You know, we won the Cold War. We're coming into restructure. We've got this newfound theories, neoliberalism. The textbooks say it should work right. The modelling say it should work right. So we're here to ensure that it's abided by. And they had enormous power on the Balkan governments, and they shaped the policy options to their own liking, very much so. And as I say, local officials were bought off. Local academics were bought off. by the prospect of being included in these rich policy circles with research scholarships to USAID in Washington and university scholarships and things like that. That sounds very prosaic, but that's pretty much, those were very powerful influences. Another aspect which I've seen, because I've done a lot of evaluations, is that evaluations of the progress of the neoliberal model were routinely rigged in favour of good news. I saw this very much with the evaluations of the microcredit programmes. They were stunningly biased. But as the people evolved would say, you know, we have to come up with good news, otherwise we don't get follow-on contracts. It was basically as simple as that. But what I see happening now is very much a situation where the original architects of the transition in the Balkans are now realising and internalising the lack of success. So they've got to come up with, what exactly did we do? You know, we know now it's all gone wrong, but somehow we've got to rationalise this. And so there's been a trend to push the argument back onto the people, in a sense, who were the victims. And we're now seeing very much a blame the victims narrative emerging in Eastern Europe. And I've been seeing this for a long time in work that I do there. But it came to a head when I saw a blog on the Brookings website by the current head of the World Bank in Southeast Europe and some colleagues, basically saying that the tragedy in Bosnia was as a result of Bosnian officials making the wrong policy decisions. And I couldn't believe what I was reading, so I responded and tried to get a debate going, but then they took the blog post off, then somehow they posted it back on, and there was all sorts of machinations about it. But it was very typical of the way that officials have reacted to the increasing bad news, that if the policies, it wasn't the policies that the World Bank gave, it must be the people themselves that are doing it all wrong. So I sense there's no genuine willingness to learn from what went wrong. And I say this in the sense that, with a sadness, that there's been lots of conferences all over the Balkans. I've gone to some of them, learning the lessons. But when you go to them, we don't seem to learn the lessons. We don't seem to investigate what really went on. And even if we do, there's very little learning, because the lessons that come out of conferences aren't actually channeled into the thinking in the World Bank or the EBRD or the other institutions. So I find that there's a lot of talk, but there's very little learning takes place. So my final slide, because I mean, I live mostly in Croatia, and so the issue of what's happening in Greece is there's a lot of discussion, because Croatia's figures are pretty scary at the moment in terms of unemployment, over indebtedness, household indebtedness. So, you know, there's a lot of focus on, you know, what's happening in Greece, and is there, you know, contagion? Is that model going to come over here and bite Croatia in the backside even more than it has already? And so I've been looking at Greece as to see, you know, what are the solutions? You know, has the European Commission learned anything from the failures of that model in the Balkans already? And what you find is, of course, that they haven't. And I've seen, for example, the EU and the European Investment Bank have pronounced microcredit. That's going to be the solution to unemployment in Greece. So I had a very strange communications with people around one of the commission, Laszlo Andor, and his advisors about microcredit. There's a 100 million facility, of which most of it's going to Greece. And so what they're hoping is that all sorts of informal enterprises are going to somehow sprout up, and that will deal with unemployment. But then I pointed out, quite a few people pointed out, well, hang on a second. I mean, the rate of micro-enterprise exit in Greece is of staggering proportions. In other words, all the coffee bars and retail shops and everything, they are massively going out of business because there are no clients, there are no customers, there's no demand. Where exactly are you going to get the demand for a new generation of coffee bars and retail outlets? And on one occasion, I got an answer from one of the main advisors, which said, well, our research showed that there's growing demand for those sorts of services. And it turned out the demand figures they gave me were from 2001 to 2003, which, of course, was before the crisis. So, I mean, there's real issues there. There's another idea that is floating around the development community, which, well, you know, the Greeks really could get a handle on SME development if only they liberalised. their regulations. And it's, I mean, you've come across the doing business sort of project within the World Bank. You know, this is about streamlining, very much influenced by Hernando de Soto in Latin America. If you strip the regulations away, all these heroic entrepreneurs will come out and they'll be able to do things. So basically, they've said the Greeks are at fault because they haven't got their regulations, you know. And the idea is that if they just get rid of some regulations, there's going to be a massive response from entrepreneurs who are otherwise desperate to get in there and do something. And as anybody who goes to Greece or knows, that's not the case. The single biggest problem there is the lack of demand. It's the same in Bosnia, it's the same in Croatia. There are entrepreneurs out there, they have ideas, they have things to sell, they have factories which they have available. If they could find some sort of local demand that they could aspire to meet. So the EU has configured the problem as a supply problem, when in actual fact, particularly in Greece, it's a demand problem. Okay? And there's no... So again, it's very usefully putting it back onto the Greeks. And again, I also saw some evidence that they're planning for the Greeks a new generation of these market-driven advisory bodies, because maybe there are entrepreneurs in Greece waiting to do something and they just need business advice and technical support. So they're setting up new generations. And again, that isn't the issue. The issue is, where's the demand? Where's the demand coming from? So in other words, almost the same recipe that has destroyed a lot of the Balkans is now being repackaged, dusted off, and it's now being sold to the Greeks as the solution to their problems. And so even though it hasn't worked anywhere else in the Balkans or anywhere else in Eastern Europe or anywhere else, even in Latin America, somehow there's an anticipation this time it's going to be different. And if you keep expecting the same tools but at a different result, I think the result, that's called insanity. Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. So this never worked in other parts of the Balkans, but somehow it's going to be working in Greece. So final slide then. So what's for the future? Well, at the moment, the Balkan economies are in, I think the correct description is depression, not so much a recession. And I would argue that, and a lot of people now are arguing, that the learning from the past mistakes in the post-war mistakes need to be learned. And I was very interested in what you said, Eddie, earlier about, you know, people are now, the younger generation are now going to look at privatisation, you know, and are going to genuinely look at what went right and what went wrong, because that's something that's new. And that's, you know, privatisation in the early 90s was all about, why would it be wrong? Of course it's what has to be done. So it's good to hear that there's a new sense of challenge. So and then also, I think, learning the success of other post-transition or post-system change economies. And there are so many good examples on the doorstep. Emilia-Romagna, southern Germany, the Basque country, that can be learned from. I know from work, when I was working as advisor in the Balkans, that we often would package up our advice by saying that we needed to go to Emilia-Romagna and these other areas. And we were always blocked from going to these countries, because it all smelled too collective, too communistic. And so, no, we won't go there. We want to go to more individualistic countries. So the study tours would be to the UK under Mrs. Thatcher, or to the United States, where there was a much more individual approach, when you had somewhere like Emilia-Romagna on the doorstep. And, of course, there's many other good examples now from countries that have industrialised, like Brazil, China, Vietnam and stuff. So I think disengaging from a failed policy model, many economists are now saying is the prerequisite for dealing with this depression, but I'm not so sure that's what the politicians are about. And I think my final argument would be that we need to understand that state institutions matter. So, you know, especially at the local level, that the power of collective mobilisation through the state has historically been very important in the most successful countries. And on the other hand, there are no examples of countries or regions or localities that successfully industrialised without powerful state institutions. So it doesn't mean to say that these institutions are always successful, but there are no examples of success without powerful institutions. And that includes the United States, as people like Mazzucato and Fred Block at Berkeley have written extensively on. So I think there's an important need to abandon ideological constraints and start to develop ideas about local development and using the power of local government and the power of community-driven institutions, and less about private sector institutions to promote development and private sector financial institutions to underpin development. So that would be my conclusion on that. So I think I went through that pretty
very
fast.
Very well timed. Yeah, quite fast, actually. Thank you very much, Miguel, for the quite powerful, I think, presentation, and quite a few issues that we can pick up in the discussion. Let me start with a kind of half question, half clarification. There's no denying that in a country which says 25, 30, 35% unemployment, there must be some sort of problem with the demand side. But also in many of these countries, we also have very, very large current account deficits. So there seems to be more demand which is satisfied from imports than domestic production, which then necessarily must mean that there must be a problem with supply as well, you know? Or preferences are very weird and nobody likes, you know, the home market effect is the inverse of it. So it must be a problem with supply as well. And I wonder whether the argument is really about whether states, you know, industrial policy or state intervention is there to stimulate that supply and create this production base, or if it is a genuine demand-side argument which says we need, I don't know, borrowing and we need more financial injections in order to stimulate demand or change the savings or whatever.
Well, I mean, I think there is an issue in terms of this import substitution. A lot of the industrial policies at the local level that were implemented in many other countries were about import substitution, but nowadays, because of WTO, you can't actually call it that. So they've done it, an import substitution policy under a slightly different sort of headings. I think a lot of the success of other countries has been about local import substitution. But the way that they've been able to get to that is through a concerted industrial policy. And I think that is what is missing in the Balkans, that any idea about tapping into demands that are currently met by foreign suppliers would raise the hackles of the institution, of the private companies wanting to come into those markets, and through various political channels have basically killed the programs. Now, I know this for a lot of the projects that we worked on in the war-affected regions in Croatia, that anything that might smack about import substitution would simply not get the go-ahead. I mean, if you were, so you couldn't actually market it under that. I think there is an element of that, but I think it's traceable back to the lack of an industrial policy in order to react to the needs that eventually were met by foreign suppliers. And I think also, I mean, a lot of the and it goes back to the privatization issue. I mean, a lot of the companies in these countries, I mean, if you go back to, say, South Korea or Taiwan after their civil wars, the government was very adept at supporting potentially growth-oriented companies. And there was finance available for them, first of all, to colonise the local market and then use that as the stepping stone, building quality and using technologies and developing innovations to then move off to export markets. And so when officials and I know this for sure in Bosnia, would quote that argument that they needed, first of all, they shouldn't allow the big companies in yet. They should promote their own companies. And then when they reached a certain level of capacity, then they can move off. Then you can take the tariffs down. The World Bank and the EBRD and the others were absolutely not in favour of that argument. And I think their spines were stiffened by companies coming in and saying, you can't do that because we want to come in and colonise the market. This is our new frontier. In terms of things like detergents and things, you had several, I won't name them, big Western multinationals that were there all the time pushing the government when they were trying to support and restructure particular detergent companies in Bosnia with using international aid. And the officials were being told by the representatives, you cannot do that. and the World Bank people were coming in and saying, on behalf, you cannot do that. And so these companies basically went out of existence, and you can't buy domestically produced detergent and toothpaste and all sorts of things. We know where we get them from, you know, which the couple of multinationals where we get them. So that was a policy. They had options. They could have decided, look, we've got all this money flooding in. We can decide to restructure and reinvigorate and recapitalize these, just like the South Koreans did and others did and the Germans did after the war. And then we'll reach a stage where we can compete. But the World Bank said, no, you know, you can't do that. You know, that's clearly not on board. So I think I take the argument that there is a supply issue, but I think it is traceable back to an unwillingness to allow the Bosnians or the Serbs or the Croats or whatever to adopt an approach which, in a sense, post-war Western Europe used to reconstruct. And I find that, and also other countries in Asia. And I find that really is the seat of the problem, I think.
Let's follow that up. There are quite a few questions, so James.
Thank you very much.
We'll take a couple of questions at the same time.
Yeah.
It's tremendously interesting talk, but I just can't help but feel you've just got this wonderfully rosy vision of how things are in the Balkans. I spend a lot of time there. You said it's all because of these policies that have been introduced. And one of your slides then gave this fantastic rundown of horrific local corruption and people not avoiding taxes. You know, it just sort of really didn't square with this thing. I think, you know, have to accept that there is a lot of really bad practice that goes on there. Yeah. And to just simply say this is bad policies of EBRD or whatever, it doesn't take into account. And also the other thing is you talk really in sort of these glowing terms about put it in the hands of the state. Look, I've seen at first hand in Serbia what happens at a local level, at a national level, where local politicians, as soon as they win the local elections, what's the first thing they do? It's not planning out how they're going to make their city a nice new place to live. It's how they're going to stuff all the local enterprises with their supporters, people who've got no business experience whatsoever, no history of entrepreneurship. They're going to get their nice job in a particular company simply because they vote for the right party. And this happens at a national level. I remember on a very, very serious discussion that was happening one night, which went late into the night, on Kosovo. Or that's what everyone thought. And I said to somebody who was very close to this, you know, this must be very serious discussions they're having on Kosovo because it's gone on, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Nonsense, he said. We got that out of the way in the first hour. This has been 5 hours of discussion on who we're going to put into the right businesses, you know, so the parties are happy. So really, I think that, you know, you present this image that, you know, we're blaming the locals and we should be looking elsewhere. And I'm saying, all right, look, maybe there has been a lot that's fault, but I think that you've just presented this wonderfully rosy image which just doesn't sort of bear up. And on one final note, I'd like to say, I know many entrepreneurs in Serbia who are doing wonderful things, and the thing that I keep hearing time and time again is they say to me, do you know anyone in Britain who we can link up with? I think that they want to have that business advice, and that's, you know, to say that, you know, this isn't a particularly valuable thing for them. I really do get this sense that this sense of information, they can't get it from their government because their government's inept and doesn't know. They desperately want to have information on export markets and how they can link up with them. And there's actually a much more vital entrepreneurial exporting culture available there than I think many people realise. Sorry, long intervention.
Yeah, long question intervention, so you can address
well, I'll
that.
Go, yeah, I think, okay. Yeah. No, I don't. Maybe I didn't make myself clear. I mean, I don't say that the bad policies by the international donor community were the only cause of the destruction, but I would argue that they were the principal cause. I mean, I take the point that local corruption is pervasive in the region, but I would make several responses to that. I think if you delegitimize the idea of a formal state response to the problems they had after the war, that local government cannot get involved and develop programs like they had in South Korea, Taiwan and other countries, you then open the door to other people say, well, if we can't do that, well, then let's just do this. So you shut one door and then you open up a door that says, well, we know that, you know, we're disempowered. We know who controls us. So we might as well just get what we can out of it. And I've heard that many times, you know, we really, from patriots who said we really wanted to do some, we had so much money flooding into Bosnia, we wanted to restructure our local businesses. The World Bank said, you can't do any of that. You can't do that. You can't do that. All you can do is just clean the streets and just try and make the schools a bit better. So really, we didn't have any power. And when people are disempowered, they go off in different directions. So I think that's one. The other argument I would make is corruption is huge in China. But at the same time, it can be overcome because they have strong and concerted local governments that adopt an industrial policy approach. And they've had the decentralization from Beijing to be able to do it. And the seat of the Chinese miracle is through efficient local government intervention and, you know, a very concerted set of industrial policy at the local level. Of course, when I think there's a bit of racism involved, when I said, you know, we should do this and we should invite Chinese consultants into Bosnia, some of the people weren't too keen on that, but their model was a very successful one and it overcame the corruption. So I think that's one thing. I mean, I think state capacity takes many forms. And I think, you know, if you go to areas like northern Italy and you see the way that local and regional governments are organised there, and also not how they're organised today, but how they developed in the aftermath of the Second World War and how they built a consensus within society that the reconstruction would be about everybody benefiting. Everybody has a right to benefit. And that consensus aspect was missing in 95. It was, you grab what you can. So I put this a lot down to the mentality of the neoliberal reforms. Very much it was about saying to people, this is about what you can get, go after it. Whereas under post-war Italy, it was more about, we're in this together, we've got to do things together. And my final point is, maybe I was misunderstood. I'm not, business advice I think is absolutely crucial. But what I'm saying is that the method of supplying it, insisting that it has to be through private consultancies, was the wrong way. And we shouldn't have this aversion to it being through the local government, but learning the lessons of others and how best to promote businesses on a non-profit basis. So maybe I was misunderstood on that, but yeah.
Yeah, I have a question and a couple of short comments. So I was wondering in terms of the if the whole dimension of human capital, so skills mismatch and of education should be brought in, because if you give some money to set up a business to somebody who has the capacity to do WhatsApp, he will do the next WhatsApp. But if you give it to somebody who knows how to do retail, they will then do retail. So I was just wondering if this whole dimension is not something to go into more. Because obviously, you know, if there's a proliferation of a certain kind of, you know, specific businesses that do not work, maybe that is something that is, you know, that stands behind the purchase missing. Then you mentioned that Apple was state funded. So to my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, but both Microsoft and Google were small private businesses that flourished. So, you know, how about that? And even if I'm not wrong, one of them got microcredit, actually. And third, you just now mentioned about, you know, decentralization in China as a successful model to fighting corruption. So there's a new book just out by Alexander Kleibling that analyzes decentralization in Croatia and Serbia, and he makes a very strong link about how actually the impetus for decentralization in the Balkans has much to do with patronage, with the distribution of control and resources.
My plan for collecting persons is gone.
Well, I can't remember all of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is something to the human capital approach, but at the end of the day, if companies are not taking on any new jobs, if there are no jobs are being created, it hardly really matters what sort of skill sets the people have. I mean, that a supply-side response, training young people into certain skills, has a certain benefit, I suppose. But if the jobs that you're training them for don't actually exist, and this is what's bedeviled a lot of African development. If there's some great articles by the late Alice Amsden about the, you know, many of the development programs in Africa were about training, you know, there was an apparent skills mismatch and they were training young people to do all sorts of jobs, you know, in certain skills. But the jobs didn't actually exist. So you can't have a supply side response if the demand side doesn't exist. And I think there's an element of that in the Balkans, that there might well be the odd company that can't find local labour. But actually, when you dig down, you know, what is it that you can't find? Well, we're looking for engineers in this particular, and this is experience I have of interviewing. So you're looking for engineers, yet we can't find them. That's why we're having to bring them in from Bulgaria. So just can you tell us how much you're trying to pay them? And the pay was ludicrous. So it wasn't that they couldn't find engineers in Croatia. They couldn't find engineers in Croatia who were prepared to work for 300 euros a month. That was the problem. So, of course, I think there's a hell of a lot of that going on as well. So, I mean, I think the mismatch, I think it exists to an extent, but I don't think it's too much of a problem. I mean, I think the Balkans economies had a very high level of human capital at the end of the war, still did. I think there's lots of skills out there. I don't think there's a real skills shortage. I think there's a job shortage. I think that's the problem. So you mentioned Google and Microsoft. I mean, those are outliers. You know, they're one in a million. It would be like basing your economic policy on winning the jackpot in a casino. You know, it
but
might.
So is Apple.
Well, yeah, but I mean, those are outliers. I mean, you know, you can't. They just happen in once or twice in a generation. So the idea that you promote entrepreneurship on the basis that you might find an Apple or a Google or something is really a very remote possibility. Those are outliers, I think. You know, the most of the jobs come from formal SMEs that are not as innovative and not as important as those. And also, going back to what I said earlier, I mean, all those examples, I mean, Google and Microsoft are famous because of their monopolies and cartels and all sorts of other problems. And Apple, of course, was very much built as a result of state investment into key technologies, which they just used off the shelf. So not all countries can make the pioneering interventions into certain technologies, which companies and individuals can do that. So the chances of having another Apple somewhere else are pretty remote if the country government concerned can't do the basic research.
The automotive industry in the US is also very state controlled. Yeah. There's a very state controlled process in the R&D and the
totally.
Production.
No, I mean, I'm not saying that like control processes. We just mentioned these other two.
But it's funny that
we can go back to this discussion, especially after the seminar. But next question.
Just a quick follow-up, and then I mean, the one thing you do seem to get is you had guys who, when it was all state controlled, were, as you say, filling the jobs with their friends, and then as soon as it became privatized, they're just privatizing it to their mates. And it seems that there's this problem that no matter what you do, the networks are such that they will always subvert the process to maintain their own interests. And there seems to be this problem of stopping the kind of patronage networks from actually subverting. The other question I had was, what's the role of local actors in this, in terms of local economists, local politicians and things like this? I mean, I've just come back, I mean, I'm a Romanian, so I've just come back from the main economics university in Bucharest. And it's so phenomenally hardcore neoliberal. Mm. You know, we need less regulation. You know, because regulation makes us inefficient. And then you think, well, okay, where is the criticism come from? I mean, there is criticism of neoliberalism from the left in critical attack in Romania, but that's sociologists, not economists.
Yeah.
You know, and they're frankly rather unreconstructed Marxists. So they're not really getting a great deal of traction, and they're just talking to themselves. But I don't see local economists critiquing what's going on. The people who... Where's that local voice, and where can that come from?
Well, I mean, most of my experience in the post-war region was in Bosnia, and at the start of the reconstruction phase, you did have a local constituency of support from a group of dedicated economists with an understanding of the development processes in the Western economies and the global South, how to say. And so they understood that. They understand, for example, the key role of issues like development banking, which was key to all the successful development episodes then and since. And they had ideas of recreating or reusing this huge inflow of funding to try to recreate key elements of that. They were unceremoniously smashed. You know, their ideas were butchered, they were pushed out, and that sent out a very important signal to anybody just under that constituency in the universities in Sarajevo, Tuzla, Mostar, whatever, that if you venture into more developmentalism, you know, that approach, you are going nowhere and you could be sacked and you certainly won't get consulting jobs with World Bank, EU and all that stuff. So once they were publicly hanged, if you like, then the message went out to the next line down that, you know, you either buy into the neoliberal miracle or you're a nobody. And so after that, once those guys were moved out, then you had this new generation of hardcore neoliberals that were going to implement the World Bank EBRD policies right down to the letter. And I think they are, as we were saying just earlier with Eddie, they are now, in a sense, coming to the end of their life, or their sell-by date. Everything's a mess, and they have no answers to why it was a mess. So they're being edged out by an even younger generation now that is saying, this thing in Eastern Europe has been a disaster. Maybe we have to look at the policy prescriptions that we uncritically accepted. So there is a bubbling up of critical, heterodox thinking and research and the willing to challenge the generation above that uncritically bought in, as partly as a because of ideological conviction that what was communist must be bad, what the Americans are selling must be good. Partly it was also opportunism. If I say this to the world at a World Bank conference, maybe I'll get a consulting job, or maybe I'll go there, or whatever. So I think there is a lot of movement now taking place in where I'm working in Pula. There are heterodox economists coming together, looking at what went wrong. There's other people working in Belgrade I've come across. You know, there are, you know, they're not very powerful at the moment, and they're not funded by the mainstream funding organisations, which is rather sad. And as you say, a lot of them aren't in the mainstream economics profession. They're in anthropology, they're in political science. There's a big movement in Croatia, an alternative movement, coming out of political science and anthropology. They're trying to recreate workers' co-ops and all sorts of heterodox things, but not out of the mainstream economics faculties, which are heavily discredited because of their uncritical acceptance of the neoliberal model when it came in.
Romania has a new government that was appointed Monday. It's hardcore neoliberal. I mean, okay. Even last week there was something that went on in the Constitution called about health policy, and the response of one of the new groupings was health is a service, not a right. And this is post 54 people dying in a fire,
yeah.
And realising that the health service is in major crisis, and this is the new government, and you're going, what chance is there of any change anytime soon?
Romania is a country, I've worked a little bit there and I found it very difficult to work in, but I don't have any up-to-date knowledge, so, but I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that it's like that. But
I'm not going to disappoint the tradition of long questions. So first one is, that's a short one. So connecting to what he was saying before, the export-driven production, Yugoslavia had two main export drivers, which was Yugoexport and Gemex. What happened with them? And what happened with the small private companies that existed in the socialist markets, Yugoslav socialist market economy? Because there existed small productions, could be private special agriculture, some technology. Did they just disappear? Were they killed? Or did they just become part of the informal economy? This is personal interest. Then the second one is, assuming that in 95, we go back there, there is a tabula rasa setting, market setting. So we're constructing markets. So we're constructing markets not from the former system, but a new type of market. According to Andreu Masculei's principles of a micro-market functioning, in order to have a well-functioning, more or less Pareto-efficient market, we need to well-define the property rights. We need to have a pricing mechanism. We need to have a market infrastructure, and this is according to Chicago School definitions, and information cost that needs to be lowered. So any type of information friction needs to be lowered ex ante. Ex post, we need to take care of externalities, blah, 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 all of those. In what you're saying, at no moment were these conditions assured that it would be working. Mm. Hence, even according to micro theory that I teach and that I work under, will the market function? This is by default, because this has been studied in many cases, both in case studies but also from a theoretical point of view. So if you don't assure these four preconditions, the market will not be functioning, or it might be functioning but definitely not Pareto efficient. Why is that? And these are economists that are my colleagues that work here and there. Is there something else driving this? Why these four conditions were not assured? Because, I mean, you were just giving cases of those four not actually being fulfilled. You were just saying it in a case-specific manner.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so the first question is, I mean, I don't quite know what happened to the big Genex and Yugo import. Yes. I mean, I think they were sort of slimmed down and then privatized or something like that. But so I know I haven't really followed what
because
happened.
Sweden and Germany had actually that model. That was Swedish and German model.
Right.
Where you have a state-driven
company, yeah.
exporter and importer
right.
that
yeah.
promotes the companies.
That would ensure
inside.
Quality control.
Exactly.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And
yeah.
assure strong partners around
yeah.
the world.
Well, I think that particular function I think was dismantled. I think they then became just like a broker function, rather than have any responsibility for issues like quality control and all sorts of other issues, because that would have been taking on a market function by the state, and that was not going to be allowed. I know in Croatia when there was an issue about we were developing cooperatives in the agricultural sector and trying to get companies in places like, well, countries like Holland and France to buy agricultural produce. And they say, well, we want a state organisation, like in other countries, to guarantee the quality of everything. And if we have problems, we want a phone number and everything. And we couldn't actually organise or even advocate for some state organisation which would guarantee the quality of Croatian produce, because institutions like the World Bank and EBRD says, no, you can't bring the state back into the equation. We've just spent the last 5 years getting the state out. So the private sector will take care of it. Of course, the private sector never did take care of it.
But do you mean, sorry to interrupt, that the World Bank was against having a certification office that would standardise?
They were against the idea of state involvement in promoting and guaranteeing the quality and marketing of particular agricultural produce. Yeah. Yeah, they were actually against it at that period. But that was about 97, 98, 99. I mean, I think after that, under EU rules, you have certification. But those are very basic types of rules. I mean, what we were talking about was an actual business or a state body that actually goes out and finds markets and does in a sense a broking function, but on behalf of Croatian agriculture in particular and agricultural cooperatives in particular. And it was that proactive role that scared a lot of people. You should always have basic standards, of course, but the market will deal with that, or else state institutions will deal with that on the EU lines, where you have basic state, you know, food standards agencies and things like that. But nothing proactive like building supply chains, because that would be too much of an industrial policy and agricultural policy. So what happened to the SMEs? I mean, most of them never really survived. My PhD, I interviewed lots of SMEs and local governments. And a lot of them, you know, most of them never survived the transition. And part of the problem was that in the chaotic conditions after the war, certainly after the transition or the collapse of communism, but after the war, when there was really no, there was a sense, as I said earlier, about grab what you can, everybody's in it for themselves. There was a movement out of businesses that were more geared towards the long term and into businesses that were all about the short term, where you could make a bit of money and then move out. So we saw a lot of businesses that had really genuinely good ideas over the long term say, well, it's not worth the candle because we get no support from anybody. We came across a lot of businesses in Bosnia that were coming out of the big construction and companies in Sarajevo, In areas quite sophisticated, electronics, optical instruments and stuff. They had good business ideas, and then they would go, well, there were no banks for SMEs. They wanted a 10-year loan, etc. No way they got anything like that. They could have a one-year, a two-year loan, you know, with huge collateral requirements. So they basically gave up on that, and they would import oranges from Morocco. So there was a lot of businesses that basically realised under the unsupported environment that was created deliberately after the war with the expectation that if you need something, the market will provide, and it didn't, and you didn't want the state to go in there, then, well, when our business is never going to get the support it needs from the state, so we'll just give up and we'll just move into something that we can, you know, usually importing. And that accounts for a lot of businesses moving into the simple import trade, because that's quick turnover and it's less risk.
So a lot...
Yeah, well, there's no value added locally, and it's quick turnover, and it's much less risky. So you saw movement out of the production sector into that, and a lot of the reason was because the environment, there was no support structures. If they'd have been in South Korea or in Germany or whatever, they'd have gone to the local government or the Chamber of Commerce or the local Office of Business Support or whatever. They would have got the required support. They would have gone to the Landesbank, and they would have got a long-term loan. That idea in Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia after the war was just not on. So the environment is totally unforgiving. It's an enabling environment. You get what you can. So you move out of long-term businesses and you move into short-term, get what you can. It's good for you, but it's not good for the society. But it was forced upon you because the environment was deliberately so unsupportive. I mean, in many of the projects we did, we were trying to create capacity in local government. And it was just absolutely cast aside. On one occasion, I mean, I worked for the Stability Pact in the... It's just an anecdote, but I worked for the Stability Pact in Paris. And I was charged with doing the country assessment report for Macedonia. So this was about going around all Macedonia. We hired a bus and we had EBRD people, us, and an OECD people joint. And we were supposed to, you know, what does Macedonia require for enterprise development? And so it was flagged up initially as we're going to ask Macedonian ministers and academics and everything. When we went round on the bus, we got very clear indication from everybody who we interviewed. We need a development bank. We need support for enterprise. We need real strong local government, has to be incapacitated to provide strong support. We got all the heterodox recommendations from the people we consulted, senior people. And I was listening to them as my colleagues from the EBRD and others were listening to them. And I was charged with writing the report. I came out, wrote up basically what we were told. It got absolutely slammed. The EBRD said, we aren't going to work. That guy has got to go. And I was shifted off that. And the woman from the EBRD said, we have got to take the state out of the equation. So we don't care what the minister says. You have to rewrite that report. So even though there was a groundswell of support and knowing that the situation was getting bad, it could not be reflected in official documents because an OECD, EBRD document had to repeat the mantra of get rid of the state, private banking, foreign banking, if preferably, all the same list. And no matter what the consultation exercise that took place, what came, that could never, you know. And they said, come on, you know how to work at the OECD, Milford. Come on. I mean, you have to, you know what you've got to write. And so they put it on and somebody else wrote that in my place. So I saw a lot of that. So
can I come into this? Because it's not clear to me also that, I mean, one can criticise the policy that was applied and say, also, as Eddie was suggesting, that to imagine that you're establishing a free market when you have not secured property rights and, when information asymmetries are pervasive and stuff, then obviously you have a problem. The efficient market hypothesis doesn't hold. So that's one thing. But then to go and say that there was essentially a political agenda or something to that effect, in a way, it also seems to me that it overlooks the political context and the sort of Seattle context of the time. James referred to that when he was talking about sort of corruption and so forth. But also, if you think that the objective of the why the international organizations went there in the first place was, okay, then you can say this is a political agenda, but it was to secure transition, that transition would happen, and you had to dismantle all the you know, so the state power that supported and expressed communism had to be dismantled. So the idea that she would then come back and say, okay, you know, now that you can try to demolish communism, how about a central plan owned by the central government, for example? You know, it just wouldn't work, because what you want to do is to abolish the central plan and disempower the central government. Yeah, but no. So when the advice was that, you know, okay, we need a development bank and state intervention in supporting business development, well, that's what, not exactly what they had, but, you know, kind of part of the model that they had before, and they were supposed to be transitioning from it. So what I'm saying is that, you know, the demand for the policy advice, at least at that abstract level, was for pro-market reforms. So then to come back and say, oh, these guys had an agenda to implement pro-market reforms is a bit unfair to those guys, in a way. I don't know.
No, I mean, I think... this goes to the varieties of capitalism approach. I think that, but you have the centrally planned economy where every last item, I mean, this didn't apply actually to the Balkans, but, you know, where the state is very heavily involved in it. And the exact knee-jerk opposite is the neoliberal model where the state has no role other than sort of a night watchman role and just, you know, property rights and all the other stuff. But in the middle, I mean, state development banks are a crucial function of most capitalist economies. But it was deliberately and knowingly portrayed as the construction of a development bank in Bosnia was knowingly portrayed as a return to communism. Instead of saying, well, that's what South Korea did. That's what Scandinavian countries did after the Second World War. So putting a positive shift on it, they would always see the negative in order that the whole idea was destroyed. So I think that was more to do with the politics of making sure that whatever happens in this region, we are going to claim that it was as a result of neoliberalism, and we'll always try to spin it into good news. It was a mixture. It was triumphalism as well. That we, you know, this is our model. You use it, or we'll be back in. I think it was a multiple. There were many reasons why, but the idea that somehow state development banking or, you know, Northern Italy type powerful regional governments promoting enterprise development was somehow a return to communism was a story promoted by institutions like the World Bank, but it had no basis in reality. It was just a lever to try to make sure that these governments didn't go back on the state capacity building route. Now, maybe some people in the World Bank actually believed that this was the best way. There were some people who said, well, it might not be the best way, but we won the Cold War and we want to get the Cold War dividend. So if there are markets to be found in Eastern Europe, well, we want to go in and get them. And the idea that we're going to create functioning big enterprises again, you know, is not really on our agenda. I mean, this was our region, and we're gonna come in and, you know, we would like to have the market opportunities for ourselves.
Back to my second question, then, but here we're not even discussing whether you provide active aid from the government, but assuring property rights, they will never assure there.
No.
That's a bigger problem, it's still a problem there.
Yeah.
Property rights are just by the ones together with with the politicians. So that is the problem. You're back to that. You have to be with party A and B, and then you get the property rights or you out. That's not property rights according to economic concepts that I teach in microeconomics. And then information asymmetries have partially been dealt with, but a very ineffective way. But definitely the pricing mechanism is working weirdly, because it's not continuous, and the pricing is actually not adapted to the local conditions, which makes it much harder actually to produce something locally, which also, of course, displaces demand, and so on and so forth. So even according to the principles of microeconomics 101, we are not fulfilling those basic conditions. And how come? Because they must have seen it in the World Bank. I mean, why? Or were there other...
No, I think certainly in the post-war environment, there was a feeling that the textbook model of liberalise everything and then this automaticity principle would kick in, and that if you need certain institutions, they will automatically arise for profit incentives. So if you need strong business support, it will automatically arise, because entrepreneurs will realise that there is a market in providing support to business. But suppose they don't realise that there is a market there, or perhaps there isn't a market there. Therefore, you don't get enterprise development. And I think in all sorts of areas, you have that problem. The banking system was a classic failure. The idea emerged that we'll have banks that come in that can intermediate the financial, whatever money's available, preferably foreign banks because they know how to do it, and they will automatically, as per neoliberal, neoclassical theory, they will automatically intermediate this money into the best possible enterprises. Well, in actual fact, they did the opposite. They intermediated into precisely the wrong enterprises, but the right ones from a profit maximisation principle, but the wrong one from a maximisation of society's benefits. So that's why you had hundreds of thousands of informal enterprises supported because interest rates were high and risk was low. There were quick turnover operations. And you had consumption lending because you had collateral which you could seize. The banks in Bosnia now are the biggest property holders, defaulting, taking the property. And there's no mileage in supporting formal SMEs because these guys can't afford to pay. They're long-term, that's complicated. So we're not going to go into that. So that was the market sort of principle would be that you know, capital markets, if they're free, automatically allocate the money to the right, the best, the most productive principles. Well, actually, they don't.
But Milford, it's not only because the World Bank is nasty or EBRD is nasty. You know, it's also because of the political institutions in the country. Mm. Because what kind of political institutions we have in the Balkans, you know. And we have to think about the broader political and the cultural context, which actually did not allow for market, which is also an institution, economic institution, actually to flourish. Market has its good points, it has its bad points, but we have in all of the former Yugoslavian countries, to my knowledge, quasi-political institutions. And we have quasi-economic institutions. So, you know, I think that was partly the reason why, in a way, one can blame the World Bank. I don't like to blame people from abroad because my field work was originally on nationalism, and I know that everybody blamed the EU for what happened in the Balkans, but actually there was our responsibilities down there also for what was going on. So, you know, I think that we have to look into these political institutions and together with the culture, which plays an important role, to be able to see why certain type of economic development and political development and cultural development hasn't worked in the last 25 years. And
before you answer, let me think, James, you want to add something?
Just a couple of points. I mean, I think, you know, the point again, you sort of say, look, maybe I've spent too much time in the Balkans and the conspiratorial sort of mindset comes out. But, you know, a lot of what you were saying about, you know, these Western, bad Western companies which were telling the World Bank to insist that, you know, follow the money. And I would often be very unsurprised if I found out that you suddenly found out that the sister or brother-in-law of a local leader had the contract for import for a number of these detergents. And it was nothing to do with the World Bank, but it's lovely to be able to say to people, oh, I know we're the victims of this big, you know, World Bank terrible thing. You know, they've told us that, you know, we can't go subsidising local, you've got to open up. You know, I'm not sure it is quite as simple as that. The second point was you said about, you were saying that, you know, it goes to oligarchs, absolutely. But I'm more convinced that those oligarchs are more interested in making money and job creation to do that than the government, which just simply has no clue as to how to do that, you know, at all. You've got people who are stuck to whatever might be, you know, all credit to them, sort of writers or whatever who happen to support the party line, columnists in newspapers, but these aren't people who've got any expertise. And also I think that you do have a local culture that has got to be taken on board. Now, somebody very close to me sort of didn't believe in insurance, refused and said, you know, and I said, what, you know, you need...
In the existence of insurance.
Absolutely, no, just didn't believe because there was no way that if something bad happened to you, they would ever pay up. It's just not going to happen, you know, and that's just one very small but very telling sort of, you know, you have to take on to account that there is a very different mindset there.
That's uncertainty because it's created as a trajectory, economic trajectory, that is a result
actually that uncertainty is not brought from heaven, but that is actually the result of not market, not functioning.
Yeah,
that is exactly
what
point.
Happens is that it creates
and
a
why
terrible environment in which
yes.
to allow this to develop, because you're dealing with very many decades of particular, which is, you know, if the Balkans were Germany, they'd be Germany, but they're not, you know, and it's sort of simply saying
okay,
it would be nice if they're like that. It would be, but it's not. And actually, as I say, I think it comes back to this point, you give the region too easy a time and let them off. Too easily.
Okay, we're running out of time, so we should give your answer to
no,
this critique, especially
I
think the cultural and political institutions.
I mean, I think there is some merit in the idea that the political institutions and culture there is not the best suited to economic development. However, no, but let's be honest, because there are many other examples of successful economic development that had exactly the same problems. And somehow they were able to overcome them. I mean, Northern Italy after the Second World War had horrendous problems. But they had a shared vision, and the people who were planning a long-term vision were given the power and given the validity, and they took the movement forward. And we know the result. And that happened in places like China. They had huge corruption, they still do, but the people who were planning, who had a vision for China, were given the power and took it forward. What happened in Bosnia and Croatia after the war was there was a section of the elite that came out, perhaps more so in Slovenia, which is why they had more success than they were Western trained. There was a section of the elite that came out and said, we want to use this windfall, and we know how development took place in the West. We want to create similar types of institutions, but embedded in local traditions. And World Bank, EBRD and the institution said, no way. And so when you're presented with a brick wall, you can't keep banging your head, you go off in other directions. Now, what you're saying is they went off in other directions. Well, yes, I would say that, but only because they had a brick wall.
But they had a brick wall also because of the ruling elite. It's also, and I would call them ruling elite, because these were the people who were oligarchs, together with the people who came to power. They were also the ones, actually, in whose interest was not to develop a viable state and economic institutions.
Well, I mean,
it's not only the World Bank.
I'm not saying it is only the World Bank, but I'm saying that the idea that they had nothing to do with the collapse wherever they seem to have applied their particular medicine. But I'm not saying that they are entirely responsible, but I'm saying they are to a large part responsible, and certainly to a large part more responsible than they would claim. And the idea that it was all down to local politicians who Bosnians screwed up Bosnia, I think that's wrong. Bosnians had ideas in the initial phase. I was working there. There was all sorts of exciting things going on, and one by one by one, they were closed down. And then it was obvious what was going to happen after that. The better people left to go abroad. All of those particularly promising angles of development were steadily shut down under this idea that, you know, the market is going to do all this. So just hang around. So initially, the first couple of years, it was all about, you know, you haven't stopped criticising what's going on in Bosnia. It needs a few more years to flourish, and then entrepreneurs will take root. And when it didn't, it was then passed on to the politicians.
Okay, I'm sorry, we have to stop here. Sorry.
No, I agree.
A place. Yeah. And the way it was supported by the political elite, it also plays an important role.
Okay. We can continue the discussion after I tell you the last announcement of the day, which is our next and last seminar of the term. Is on Wednesday, 2nd of December, same room, by Dr. Lawrence Rentay, I think. Yes, on constructive incoherence, contesting Kosovo status in the European Union. So we'll move a bit further south and less into the economics. Hope to see you there on the 2nd of December. Let's thank Milford Bateman for his presentation and a very lively discussion.